ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago tomorrow, November the 11th, 1975, the then Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, dismissed Labor Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, and it created the biggest scandal in modern Australian political history. The scene was set in mid-October that year after Labor's Minerals and Energy Minister Rex Connor had resigned after being shown to have misled Parliament over ongoing negotiations for foreign loans with the financier Tirath Kemlani. Every metropolitan newspaper in Australia had called on the Whitlam government to resign, and the then opposition leader Malcolm Fraser announced that in the Senate, where the Liberals and the then Country Party had the numbers, they would delay two appropriation bills, that is, block supply, unless Prime Minister Gough Whitlam called a federal election, even though one was not due until 1977, in 18 months' time. Blocking supply meant that money for public costs like pensions, public servant wages, funding for the defence forces and other government services would not be available. So the Whitlam government was being held to ransom, call an election or else. But in the House of Representatives, Labor had the numbers and a motion of confidence in the government had been passed. But then a few weeks later, things came to a head on the morning of the 11th of November. It seemed something had changed, and coalition MPs reportedly had a different look about them. Something was afoot.
It's now the 27th day since Malcolm Fraser made his monumental statement that the air must be cleared.
Never seen you fellas up so early.
The opposition is still urging for a general election. The Prime Minister remains firm. The only hope lies in this morning's meeting.
The Honourable Member for Wannon.
Mr. Speaker, this afternoon the Governor-General commissioned me to form a government until elections can be held.
Order!
Mr. Whitlam has been dismissed by the Governor-General and Mr. Malcolm Fraser will become caretaker Prime Minister of Australia pending a general election. Following the news, which hit the national capital like a bombshell, the Senate has passed the budget.
We have had the extraordinary situation of the Labor Party still sitting on the government side of the House because they maintain they've got the numbers.
Sir John Kerr's done a completely unprincipled act.
You're saying that Sir John Kerr's completely unjustified?
He's completely unjustified. I wouldn't resile him for a second. Completely and totally unjustified.
Keating was ropeable. He said to me off air, unfortunately he didn't say it on air, he should be locked up and put in jail.
Are you critical of the Governor General's action?
I think that the Governor-General's decision is wrong, but I'm not going to engage in personal criticism of him, but his decision is an incorrect one.
Thank you very much.
Proclamation by His Excellency the Governor-General of Australia.
God save the Queen.
Well may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General. The proclamation which you have just heard read by the Governor-General's official secretary was countersigned Malcolm Fraser. Who will undoubtedly go down in Australian history from Remembrance Day 1975 as Kerr's Kerr.
Yes, it was an amazing day. I was there. I had just finished a university exam when news came that it was flying everywhere of what had happened. I raced over to Parliament House and was there on the steps of Parliament House. I'd missed the proclamation and Gough's address. But even in that early part of the evening, there was still a large number of people there. I remember opposition senators with their heads out the window of the what was then the opposition senators' party room, exchanging gestures and comments back and forward to the crowd. In the thick of it, of course, were two young MPs, John Howard, who would go on to become Prime Minister on the Liberal side, and Labor side, John Dawkins, who had become Federal Treasurer as well as holding a host of other ministerial portfolios in his political career. Well, we'll speak to Mr. John Howard soon, but firstly, let's talk to John Dawkins. John, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife. Thanks for joining us to remember Dismissal Day.
Thanks, Philip. Pleased to be here.
Where were you on that day?
Well, the day started as relatively normal. It was a Tuesday, so there'd been a caucus meeting The Parliament hadn't sat. The House of Reps hadn't sat. The Senate sat from 12, but that was nothing to do with me. So everything seemed relatively normal, other than the fact that there was a general sense of crisis which had been going on for some time about the failure of the Senate to pass the budget and what was going to happen as a result of that.
So there was no hint that day, though, that things were going to reach the crisis point that they had.
Well, there were two camps. There were those in the opposition who knew what was going on, already knew that Kerr was going to sack Whitlam. And this was a kind of a conspiracy that had been hatched between the opposition and Kerr and forces outside, particularly in the media. But for the rest of us, we didn't think that Kerr had the – we didn't accept this thing which became very much talked about later, the so-called reserve powers. We didn't believe that the reserve powers overrode the Constitution saying that it was the House of Reps who was in charge of appropriating money. And whilst the Senate unfortunately had equal powers, it had not in the past ever blocked a budget. So we thought the constitutional conventions were that a government which had a majority in the House of Representatives could not be frustrated, at least in relation to the appropriation of monies, by a kind of out-of-control Senate.
Yeah. So on that day, when do you first hear about it? When does the caucus first hear about it?
Well, those of us who made up the caucus only knew about it really just before the Parliament sat. And when the Parliament sat, Fraser got up and said, I advise the House that the Governor-General has appointed me as Prime Minister, to which the response was howls of derision. And then Whitlam immediately moved a motion of no confidence in Fraser as Prime Minister. So the debate then in the House of Reps was all about the legitimacy of Fraser to be Prime Minister when he didn't have a majority in the House of Representatives. But that was kind of trying to bolt the door after the horse had bolted.
The whole sequence of events here is intriguing, isn't it, John? John Dawkins is my guest. He was a new MP at the 1974 election representing the South Perth seat of Tangney, was just 28 in November 1975. There's an intriguing set of events here, isn't there? Because Sir John Kerr says to Malcolm Fraser, I'll commission you as Prime Minister, but you have to call an election, you have to get the supply bills passed and so on. So Fraser goes back. So at that point, supply had been, well, hadn't been actually refused, but they'd refused to debate the supply bills in the Senate. That was the sticking point. Those bills were quite quickly passed, but did they need to be?
No, this was, I think, a tactical blunder.
By who?
Well, by the government, by the Whitlam government, because Gough is sacked around 1 o'clock. Fraser is appointed. Gough goes back to the lodge, has a meeting with his office, his advisors, and they focus on what they were going to do in the House of Representatives by moving no confidence in Fraser. However, separately, they had failed to advise Ken Reet, who was the leader of the government in the Senate, that Whitlam had been sacked and Fraser had been appointed. Now, the debate which was happening, the Senate had started sitting at 12 o'clock. By the time it got to a bit after 2, that is an hour later, an hour after the change of Prime Minister, Reet still didn't know that that had happened.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, he didn't know. And Withers, who was the leader of the opposition, he knew exactly what was going on because he had been one of the chief architects of the whole strategy to bring the government down. So Reet, not knowing what had happened, he gets up and says, I mean, this is all about messages passing between the two houses, but the crucial thing was that Reet moves that the appropriation bills, in other words, the budget, be passed forthwith. And of course, this was like a gift to Withers, because what it then meant was that the budget was now passed, but it had been passed for the wrong Prime Minister.
But hang on, Ken Reid didn't know at that stage?
Ken Reid didn't know that there'd been a change of Prime Minister.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah. And there had been so much emphasis within the Whitlam camp focusing on what they were going to do in the House of Reps, they forgot to focus on the Senate, which is where the problem existed in the first place. Mm. Now, had Reid not moved the motion he did, the budget would have remained locked up in the Senate, at least for a while, and there could have been no election, because Kerr wouldn't have agreed to an election if Fraser hadn't been able to guarantee supply, which he couldn't, because the appropriation bills under my scenario, or the scenario I've just sketched, would have still been in the Senate unpassed. So we would then have had a continuation of the constitutional crisis, which would have gone on for probably weeks, certainly days. Mm. And the subsequent election would have been about the behaviour of the Senate and the Senate's obstructionism, rather than, as it turned out to be, because the budget was, I think, accidentally passed under these circumstances, the election became an election about the conduct of the Whitlam government. And the whole issue of the behaviour of the Senate, the behaviour of Kerr, simply disappeared as an issue within a week or so.
Mm.
So the election really, the only issue that the election resolved was to install Fraser for 3 years. It did nothing about resolving the constitutional question of, was the Governor-General entitled to do what he did? Was the Senate entitled to do what it did? Because those two issues got forgotten in the hurly-burly of the election.
Mm. Others have pointed to tactical blunders too by Whitlam, who some say should have acted more quickly to sack John Kerr. But then again, he didn't know what John Kerr was going to do, did he?
No, I think what Whitlam thought, I mentioned before that there'd been a sense of crisis because the budget hadn't been passed. And the numbers in the Senate on the, at least when there was a division on the 11th of November, the numbers were 28-29. So there were 28 on the Labor side, which included Steele Hall, at least. I'm not sure who else. And there were 29 Libs and Country Party people. So they only had a majority of one. And I think Whitlam's view was that if this thing was allowed to continue for a bit longer and the calling of a half-Senate election was part of that strategy, then the Senate would crack.
Mm.
I mean, I think that was as legitimate a view as any, putting to one side the unthinkable, which was at the time, that the Governor-General would intervene and sack the government. So there was a guy, you'll probably remember this, a guy called Alan Misson, who was a Victorian Liberal, and he was a kind of very small or liberal, very decent guy, and he was very concerned. He was concerned about two things. One was he didn't believe that the Senate should be trying to upend a government that had a majority in the House of Representatives. And his second thing was that, and if they did proceed and that Fraser was installed, that Fraser's legitimacy would be forever in question, which of course it was.
Mm.
It was certainly in question up until maybe the 90 election at least. So he had to survive years when he was considered to be someone who was illegitimately installed.
Mm. Yeah, one of the key constitutional questions, I suppose, that gets not lost but has never been properly addressed here is that, of course, back in the House of Representatives, once Malcolm Fraser's got up and said he's been commissioned as Prime Minister, a no-confidence motion's moved against him and is passed in the House of Representatives. The House Speaker, Gordon Scholes, says, "I'm going to see the Governor-General now to inform him that the House has no confidence in the government of the day, that is the government led by Malcolm Fraser, which is, under the conventions, room to dismiss the government." That wasn't followed because Sir John Kerr thinks, "Oh, no, that's not what I've decided."
Well, no, not what he had decided, but what he had done. What he had done, whether he had the power to do it or not. He had removed Whitlam, he had installed Fraser, and he had accepted Fraser's advice that there should be a double dissolution election.
Mm.
Now, my point is that he could only have done that on the basis of the accidental passage of the budget in the Senate by an unknowing Ken Reet. And if Ken Reet had simply not moved the motion that he moved and the Senate adjourned and maybe would never have resumed because the resumption of the Senate was in the hands of the President, who was Justin O'Byrne, who was a Labor senator. So this thing could have continued on for some considerable time with, you had Fraser there, who was appointed only for the purposes of calling an election.
Mm.
But there was no election because Kerr couldn't agree to his advice because there was no money. The supply hadn't been given. So you would have had this terrible mess, which would have to have been resolved one way or another. But it would have played out in the public mind as, oh, well, this is all caused by the fact that the Senate jacked up and wouldn't pass the budget. The money's running out. The pensioners aren't going to be paid, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there would have been a real issue about, A, whether the Senate, you know, was right in blocking the budget or at least delaying it, and whether Kerr was right in sacking the government. So it would have been a much better argument to have at that point because it would have been about the real issue, that is, the behaviour of the Senate and the behaviour of Kerr. But those two issues disappeared as soon as the proclamation was read on the steps of Parliament House to call an election, prorogue the Parliament, and we were all off to an election campaign, which turned out to be, thanks to a very aggressive media, all turned out to be the behaviour of the Whitlam government in the previous 6 months. But ignoring the fact that the Whitlam government, despite all of that, still had the numbers in the House of Representatives and had a constitutional authority to govern.
Mm. John Dawkins is my guest. We're talking about the dismissal in 1975. With the passage of time, you often get the view back these days, oh, well, yeah, what, it was a fuss, but it was all resolved because there was an election. What's the problem?
Yeah, well that's...
What's wrong with that view of the world, do you think?
Well, no, but that's exactly my point. And I think the fact that the that's how it played out didn't really give legitimacy to the events which caused the sacking, that is, the Senate and Kerr. It's just that I think once the election was underway, it did become about whether or not the Whitlam government should be elected or re-elected, given what had happened in the previous 6 months or so.
Yeah.
So I do accept that, that being the case, there was a kind of the election did provide a kind of closure for that issue, but it's just a tragedy that the issue that was really at the heart of it, which was the reprehensible behaviour of the Senate in blocking the budget and the reprehensible behaviour of Kerr in sacking the government, those two issues just got subsumed by everything else.
All right, John Dawkins, it's been a pleasure to relive events and to have your memories of it as well. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, you were there, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah.
I was.
You were on the steps.
I was on the steps outside Parliament House late that afternoon. I'd finished a university exam and come over to have a look.
I was on the steps standing just – I'm not in the photograph – but I was on the steps just behind Whitlam, probably blocked out by the phalanx of journalists who were surrounding him.
Yeah, it was quite a day. All right, appreciate your time, John. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
This is Nightlife, and tonight we're looking back on the 50 years since the dismissal of the Whitlam government in 1975, 50 years ago tomorrow. Let's speak with the former Prime Minister, John Howard, who was the young MP for Bennelong at the time. John Howard, good evening to you and welcome to...
Good evening, Philip. You're well, I trust.
Yes, no, extremely well. Welcome to Nightlife. Look, just going back to that fateful Tuesday, November the 11th, 1975, where were you on the day?
Well, I was attending a sitting of Parliament. I'd been elected to Parliament in May 1974. And when the dismissal occurred, I was involved in one of those almost interminable debates about whether the opposition should have delayed supply in the Senate. And I don't know whether we'd move the motion or Labor would move the motion. And I know we adjourned for lunch. Right. And I remember it very clearly. And I remember after the bell started ringing to call Parliament back for the afternoon session, I ran into Vic Garland, who was the opposition whip, and he said, Kerr has sacked Gough.
And what, you found this after coming back from lunch?
Yeah, after I came back from lunch. And I recalled later, while I had had lunch, I went for a bit of a walk and was standing on the steps of Parliament House, and Frank Crean, the then Deputy Prime Minister, who was a very polite, courteous, decent man in every way, just brushed past me and said, I'm sorry, John, and being very polite. And I realised later that he was obviously on his way to the lodge to join Whitlam for lunch, that celebrated steak. But unfortunately, Gough hadn't invited Ken Reid, the leader of the government in the Senate. So I went back into the house and I ran into Vic Garland. And Vic Garland said to me, Kerr has sacked Gough, and I couldn't believe it. But after Parliament resumed, Gordon Scholes, the Speaker, called Fraser to speak. And instead of calling him the leader of the opposition, he called him the Honourable Member for Wannon, which he was. But, of course, he was no longer opposition leader, and I realised then that what Garland had told me was right. And of course, we then had a fairly noisy session. Fred Daly moved a motion of no confidence in the caretaker Prime Minister, and the House erupted and it was carried and the House adjourned, and then the crowd gathered out and Whitlam strode out and delivered his well-remembered lines of, well, may we say God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor-General.
How much in advance, because one of the, I suppose, over the years we've come to know more about the events of the day and the week preceding, etc., it was clear that some people were more in the know than others, that Reg Withers in the Senate, for example, knew more about what was going on than Ken Reid knew.
Well, that was extraordinary, and that wasn't because of any behaviour by Fraser or Kerr. It was just Whitlam's complete indifference to the Senate, which, when you think about it, was quite extraordinary. I thought Whitlam was a very impressive parliamentarian and all of that, but I, in retrospect, his behaviour, in particular his failure to inform and involve his Senate leaders, was extraordinary.
Yeah, looking back, of course, that's right. It's that if he had involved them, events may have have been different.
They might have engaged in some delaying tactic in the Senate. Apparently, as I understand, what happened was that Withers just facilitated the passage. And Reid said to him, in an aside, oh, you've come to your senses, Reg. Well, he certainly had.
Because at that stage, of course, Reg Withers was well aware of what had happened, that Whitlam had been sacked.
I think that was the most extraordinary logistical lapse of the whole day.
It's an interesting perspective. Looking back at the time, I mean, you were there at the time, Mr. Howard, you'd recall it was a fevered political environment, wasn't it? We had the Kamlani loans affair and so on, and it was a time of great partisanship, wasn't it? Tell me about that.
Oh yes, and I felt no particular joy about what had happened, in the sense that I didn't feel triumphal or anything about it. I felt rather tense that the country had been getting more head up over it.
Mm.
There was more tension, and I think people were starting to worry about salaries not being paid, maybe service personnel, soldiers, sailors and airmen going without pay, public servants not being paid. And it was just a general feeling that the public wanted the standoff to finish, but they hadn't deserted. They hadn't changed their mind about the government. And that, of course, was demonstrated in the result. It was an overwhelming victory for the coalition, and Fraser got the biggest majority. He got a majority of over 50 in a parliament then that was only 124.
Yeah, that's true. One of the theories, Mr. Howard, was that if it had gone on longer, if the Senate obfuscation and delay had gone on longer, that public concern might have turned against the Senate. Was that something that the government, the opposition at the time, was worried about?
Public opinion had begun to turn. I think you will find, if you look at the polls, that they had started to drift against the coalition. But once the standoff ended, people reverted to a traditional attitude of being either for or against the government. And, of course, as the result in the election demonstrated, I think the election result was a demonstration of what people thought about the government's performance, not what they thought about the constitutional crisis or standoff. I don't think that at all. I think they were simultaneously anxious that the standoff finish, but equally keen to have a vote.
Yeah. What do you make of it from this distance now, John? Because we look back, and I mean, there are people who say, yes, well, hang on, if you look at what happened on the day, the lower house, which is where governments get formed, the House of Representatives, that's where the government is formed. And on the day, a motion of no confidence was passed against Malcolm Fraser and carried. And Gordon Sculls, the House Speaker, went to deliver that to Sir John Kerr, who should have accepted the advice and therefore recommissioned Mr. Whitlam. There's a constitutional point here which has never really been resolved, hasn't it, and sort of has sat there as perhaps a thorn in the arrangements, or is that not the way you would see it?
Okay, I think by the time that motion reached the Governor General, hadn't the Parliament been dissolved?
Events had moved on, yes.
I think it was after the event. I think what you have to say is that the Constitution worked, and it's remained completely unchanged since. And there have been several attempts to amend it since, and they've all failed. There was an attempt made in the 1980s to amend it at the instance of Lionel Bowen, who was then the Deputy Prime Minister, and then, of course, the voice referendum. Australians are very reluctant to change that constitution because they think it works. I think one of the things that really came through to me was the faith the public retained in the institutions we had. I mean, they, mind you, that faith and trust was sorely tested. But in the end, the constitutions remained. And if ever there was anything to build momentum for a big change, it should have been 1975. Now, certainly 1975 gave a certain spur to the Republican movement in Australia. But, of course, it didn't succeed, and even though it was given every opportunity with a convention and a properly funded referendum.
What do you make of the revelations from the Palace letters uncovering that Buckingham Palace had a much more significant role in advising the Governor-General What do you make of that? I mean, there are plenty of people who say that shouldn't have happened.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure that those letters reveal that. I think the letters reveal that the Queen had absolutely nothing to do with. She was kept informed, but she didn't involve herself. And my reading of the palace letters was that demonstrated that the Queen was not involved in any way and we didn't know. And according to all the accounts I've read, she slept through the crisis moments. Mm. And even that arch Republican, my predecessor as Prime Minister, Paul Keating's on record as saying that any suggestion that the Queen was involved was nonsense.
Mm.
That's my understanding, and other people may have a different view, but I think what Kerr did was done in accordance with his reading of the Constitution and his belief in the adequacy and effectiveness of the reserve powers, and people were critical of him. I have always felt that he was the meat in the sandwich and was cast by history in this invidious position of having to resolve it. And the only way, after that meeting on the morning of the 11th of November, when Fraser and Philip Lynch and Doug Anthony made it very clear that they were not going to resile from blocking supply, and Whitlam said all he was going to do was to advise a half-Senate election, which was due anyway, but wouldn't have resolved the impasse, it was obvious that something had to give. Now, I think it's fair to say that it's subsequently been revealed or confirmed rather than revealed that Kerr had reached a conclusion that the time had come to act. Those who criticise what he did are really arguing, aren't they, that he should have just allowed a bit more time. I'm not sure that allowing more time would have solved anything, because if you're going to have an election, proper election, full election, you had to have that, call it pretty soon. And you may remember that the election was held on the 13th of December.
Yes, it was.
Mm. Well, given that the whole show closes down for most of January, you were running out of time the moment of truth had arrived.
Mm. Given, look, its legacy, it could happen again, because after all, nothing constitutionally, as you observed, has changed. So supply could again be blocked and we could have a similar crisis again. Is there any, do you think now there's any legacy of division over it, or is it simply regarded as a controversial period in Australian politics?
Oh, I think in theory it could happen again. I think in practice that's unlikely.
Hmm.
But it has happened before on a state basis, sort of, but you can't stop it happening again while you have a Senate that is fully elected and it has coextensive powers with the House of Representatives, except that you can't initiate a money bill in the Senate.
Mm.
And in that way, the Senate in Australia is more powerful, much more powerful than, say, the House of Lords in Britain or the Canadian Senate, the latter of which is fully appointed.
Mm.
And New Zealand doesn't have an upper house.
I'm sure you, as Prime Minister, might be looking back and thinking, I wish we didn't have one either.
Well, that's true.
I think every Prime Minister shares that view.
That was the price that was paid for Federation.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have got the smaller states to join the Federation you hadn't have had a Senate with equal representation.
No, that is
and,
true.
And could I say, I think this, while I'm thinking about parliaments and houses and everything, this suggestion that we should have more members of parliament is ridiculous. We've already got a large house, and you already have the absurdity of, what, 5 House of Representatives seats from Tasmania and, what, 12 senators.
That's right.
And if you add 10, 12 reps, you've got to add 5 or 6 senators, and you've got to add 6 really, because you've got to have one from each state.
Hmm.
Nearly as practicable. Oh.
You're going to have to build a parliament house for the Senate. That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Howard, appreciate your memories, and thanks so much for joining us this evening.
It's been a great pleasure, Philip. Cheerio.
This is Nightlife, and we're looking back on 50 years since the dismissal of the Whitlam government back in 1975. Well, let's speak to the preeminent dismissal historian and political scientist Jenny Hocking. Jenny is Emeritus Professor at Monash University, the inaugural Distinguished Whitlam Fellow and at the Whitlam Institute of the University of Western Sydney. She's also the author, most importantly, of the Palace Letters and biographies of Gough Whitlam and Whitlam-era Attorney General Lionel Murphy. Jenny famously won a High Court bid in 2020 to release the Palace Letters, so-called, which was correspondence between the Palace and the Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, which proved at the very least that the Queen's private secretary, Sir Martin Charteris, was in secret and pretty detailed contact with Governor-General Sir John Kerr about the political and constitutional circumstances leading to the dismissal. Jenny Hocking, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil. It's great to be here.
It's fair to say we know. Do we know everything now, do you think, about what happened?
Look, I think with the dismissal, you have to say never, because I think we've found out so much in the last probably 20 years in particular that has been really quite shocking to many people about what happened and about the extent of Kerr's discussions with others that had always been denied previously. That I'd be loath to say we now know everything there is to know, for the simple reason that I found so many things I never expected to find previously. So I do think there's probably more to come. And the reason I say that is that there are many, many files in our own National Archives, some directly relating to the dismissal in Sir John Kerr's papers, others peripheral to it, but from the same time, like from Prime Minister and Cabinet Department and so on, that the archives is refusing to open and refusing to release. And I find that really quite disturbing. But it's another reason why, yes, there is a lot more, I think, meat to put on the bones of the dismissal, if you like.
Mm. At the time, of course, it was portrayed, and indeed by Sir John Kerr, as a considered decision he was making on his own. We knew he'd had some advice from the High Court Chief Justice, didn't we? But the extent of the palace advice wasn't known, not really until you secured the release of these letters, was it?
That's right. Look, there are some core pillars, if you like, to what was seen as the history of the dismissal as it emerged. And the central one, of course, was that Kerr always claimed he acted alone, that he did not discuss this with others, he did not take the advice of others. Now, we knew at the time only that Sir Garfield Barwick, the Chief Justice, had, as Kerr put it, provided him with a written document only after Kerr had already made up his own mind, which is rather an odd way to look at it. And we knew that a second High Court Justice, Anthony Mason, had also looked at that in the days before the dismissal, but no more than that. And certainly central to it was Kerr's claim and the palace's claim that there was no involvement from the palace, that the palace played no part, and this is the language they used at the time and since, in the decision that Kerr made. Mm. Now, when I looked through Kerr's papers in the archives about 15 years ago when I wrote the biography of Gough Whitlam, I was staggered to see how many references there were by Kerr directly to the palace letters, and it was clear that they were playing a far greater role than we'd been told. And in fact, in one of the documents, he refers quite specifically to the Queen's private secretary, Sir Martin Charteris. He writes, "Charteris's advice to me on dismissal." It could not have been more explicit. So it was obvious that their discussions were far more than we'd been led to believe. And I then sought, unsuccessfully at that stage, to have the National Archives open that correspondence between the Queen and Sir John Kerr.
Mm, which has not been opened.
It had not been opened before, and it should never have taken a High Court action and 4.5 years of legal action on my part for it to be opened, because it is a critical part of our history. I mean, these letters, of which there are over 200, are absolutely extraordinary. They're extremely concerning. Kerr raises the possibility of dismissing the government first with Prince Charles in September 1975. So this is 2 months before the dismissal actually happened. They enter into a detailed discussion about the potential use of the reserve powers to dismiss the government. The palace and the Queen and Prince Charles know that Kerr is not being honest and open and transparent to the Prime Minister, the elected government. They know that he later on during these discussions indicate that he may not take the formal legal advice of the Australian Solicitor General, Sir Maurice Byers, and indeed he did not take that advice. So it's very disturbing that the palace involves itself so politically when they state publicly that they are politically neutral and do not become involved in domestic political matters. They were involved, and we know that now because of the letters.
Because the Constitutional Convention was quite clear, isn't it, that the Governor-General acts on the advice of the Prime Minister.
So long as the government retains the majority of the House of Representatives, which Whitlam and the Whitlam government did at all times, there is no question that in a constitutional monarchy, the cardinal principle is that the Crown or the representative of the Crown, in Kerr's case, acts on the advice of what's called responsible ministers, that is, ministers who have been, who are part of the elected government. And that is a cardinal principle that was breached repeatedly during 1975. And I think it's why we continue to have this interest and discussion about what happened in 1975, because the extent of the intrigue and what Sir Anthony Mason actually said to Kerr, if you don't warn Whitlam, you run the risk of being seen as deceptive. And that, you know, that personal moral element of the deception of a prime minister, I think, is also very disturbing. So as these things have come to light, I think there's always new interest around every new archival revelation.
Why didn't Kerr tell Whitlam what he was going to do? The supposition is because he was very concerned that Gough Whitlam would sack him. Is that right?
Well, I think that appears to be, certainly from Kerr's own description, he never seems to have veered from stating that he feared that Whitlam would dismiss him from office. Now, if that was a concern for the Governor-General, it is not an appropriate concern on which to act in according to your constitutional responsibilities. Former Justice Michael Kirby made a really telling comment about this, made it clear that he thought that Kerr, acting in any way as a result of concern for his own position, was simply not appropriate. And Kirby said, you know, people give their life for their country when they work in the military, for example, and having concern for your own position in this way, when the position is nothing other than an appointed position, should never have been a consideration for Kerr at that time.
I'm speaking to distinguished politics and political historian Jenny Hocking, the preeminent historian of the dismissal, the uncoverer of the palace letters, amongst other things as well. Is it clear from what you've discovered that the palace knew full well what Sir John Kerr was planning to do? The Queen was well aware of what Sir John Kerr was planning to do. In other words, they knew in advance.
Look, I think they may not have known the exact day on which Kerr was going to act, but there's no doubt that they were well aware of the path that Kerr was taking. Kerr had set out for them very clearly his interest in the reserve powers, and they bolstered that at various points throughout the letters. One of those is pointing Kerr in a relatively early piece in September 1975. The Queen's private secretary makes a note on the bottom of one of these letters indicating that Kerr might be interested in the work of a Canadian theorist and senator, Eugene Fawzy, who was well known as someone who was very strongly supportive of an activist notion of the reserve powers, who had written extensively on the monarchy and the continuing role of the monarchy and the potential use of the reserve power. So it was a very pointed reference. But right through to letters towards the end in which they assuage concerns that Kerr had expressed about the potential use of the reserve powers in Australia, and Sir Martin Charteris writes to him and makes it clear that that it could not do any harm to the monarchy. And there are very strong words in these final letters to Kerr. And I think in particular the fact that the palace was well aware that Kerr was not speaking and remaining silent, as Kerr put it, to the Prime Minister about this ought to have been a measure of concern for the palace. The appropriate role for the Governor-General as the Queen's representative was to warn and speak to and counsel the government, and he chose not to, and the palace was well aware of that.
Mm. What could they have done about it, do you think?
I think what they ought to have done was not enter into these conversations with Kerr in the first place.
Right.
Malcolm Turnbull wrote a wonderful foreword to my book, The Palace Letters, and in that he makes it clear that in his view he had anticipated that Charteris would not engage with Kerr in these sorts of personal matters, that he would, the political matters, that he would in effect create some sort of barrier around the areas that they could properly discuss. But to his surprise, in fact, Charteris and Kerr discussed the constitutional and political issues that are at the heart of the dismissal in great detail.
Mm.
And I think all that needed to happen really was at the palace to make it absolutely clear to Kerr that this was not an area that they felt Kerr, or them for that matter, ought to be discussing, that Kerr's proper advisers was the elected government, his responsible ministers, in particular his chief advisor, the Prime Minister, and the Solicitor General, of course, as his chief legal advisor, and that they were the people that Kerr ought to be speaking to about this, not the palace. These are conversations that should simply not have taken place.
Mm. The concept of the reserve powers, it's an ill-defined power, isn't it? It's an ill-defined constitutional fact. Tell me what our understanding is these days of what the reserve powers of the Governor-General are.
Well, these are powers, they're called reserve powers because they are the reserve powers from of the Crown. They're reflecting another time, a time of far more autocratic monarchical power, and they're sort of residual powers that most people, most theorists, certainly political scientists, would have considered had by 1975, even by the 1960s, have become overtaken by what you might see as the democratic fabric of the way in which our parliamentary system works in practice. And it would have been, I think, unthinkable for a Governor General, who is, after all, an appointed official, who has no electoral mandate or foundation, could remove a government that has been elected and that, I stress this, that retains at all times the confidence of the House of Representatives, as Whitlam did. It's really important to remember that after the dismissal, the House of Representatives continued to sit, and Whitlam put forward a motion which was supported by the House of Representatives, which was a motion of no confidence in the appointed Fraser government.
Mm.
Fraser lost that motion by 10 votes, and that same motion called on the Governor-General to commission a government led by the member for Werriwa, that is, Gough Whitlam.
Mm.
So the House of Representatives had spoken on the formation of government. Supply had been passed a good 45 minutes to an hour before. And so the expectation in terms of how our system works is that the Whitlam government should have been recommissioned, and the Speaker was sent to Government House to convey that motion of the House. That's the all-important motion. So the use of the reserve powers in that context, in which we have a government that beyond question has the support of the House of Representatives, is what makes this particularly questionable. It's not a situation in which a minority government in the House, for example, has fallen and the Governor-General has to consider a question about who should they now call on to form a government. The House of Representatives had reached that decision. And I call that the second dismissal because it is the point at which Kerr then dismisses really the Parliament as a whole and says, I will not accept your Speaker, I will not accept the motion that you have just passed. My choice of the formation of government, that is Malcolm Fraser, stands regardless.
Mm.
And I find that deeply concerning.
Yep. Jenny Hocking is with us. I suppose a final question, Jenny, could it happen again? Nothing has actually constitutionally changed, so I guess it could, couldn't it?
Look, it could happen again, and I think we need to be very alert to the circumstances in which it might happen again, because despite the fact that we went to an election and we continued and, you know, political life goes on, it was a deep rupture in our political structures and a deep rupture in the political process that could have ended up in a much more, I think, divisive and polarising way had other people been involved than the ones that were. And what we see is that none of those key elements have actually changed. The only thing that has changed is the way in which we fill casual Senate vacancies, because, of course, the only reason the Senate had the capacity to diversify is because two Labor senators had been replaced by non-Labor senators. Mm. That changed the makeup, the political makeup of the Senate. And there was an outcry about that, but nevertheless, that pertained in 1975. That was changed by referendum in 1977. Other than that, the capacity for Governor General to take these reserve powers in its broadest possible meaning is still exists today. The possibility of blocking supply by refusing to vote on supply, because
that still exists, isn't it? Yeah.
That still exists. Supply had not been rejected. In fact, it had not even been voted on. What had happened is that the coalition in opposition in the Senate had moved a motion that the budget bills be returned to the House of Representatives, demanding that the government go to an election, and it would not consider the budget bills until it agreed to do that. So the budget bills were still alive. They were still before the Senate. So all of those things could happen again. And I think in order to protect our parliamentary structure and formation of government, what we need to consider in a future constitutional change would be to protect the formation of government through a motion of the House of Representatives.
Yeah. Yes, it's completely fascinating and still today is a live issue, even for those who it is but a childhood memory. Jenny Hocking, it's been terrific to have the benefit of your wisdom and research and experience in the matter, and I do thank you.
Thank you very much, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.